smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
We all know that dogs have exceptional hearing. But how they hear and what they hear is a mystery to most of us. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and welcome to the Good Dog Podcast, where my guest today is psychoacoustics expert Joshua Leeds, who, along with veterinary neurologist Dr. Susan Wagner, has both a book and a CD on the market entitled Through a Dog's Ear, Using Sound to Improve the Health and Behavior of Your Canine Companion. In fact, you're hearing music from the CD Through a Dog's Ear right now. Joshua, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
It's good to have you here. Define psychoacoustics for us, please.
Yeah, psychoacoustics is the study of the perception of sound, or put in another way, it is the exploration of the effect of music and sound on the human nervous system.
Specifically, the human nervous system.
Yes, the human nervous system.
So how did you become interested in the impact of sound on dogs?
Well, about 5 years ago, I was called by a wonderful concert pianist, a Juilliard graduate, a wonderful gem hidden down right now in Half Moon Bay by the name of Lisa Spector. And she had attended a lecture that I was giving about psychoacoustics and the therapeutic applications of music and sound, and had found it to be efficient and effective in her work with her own students, her own musical students, that she a thought occurred to her. She at the time was raising puppies for guide dogs for the blind, and she had noticed in the process of doing that when she played certain kinds of music on her 9-foot Steinway piano, that certain music would cause the dogs to just rip up the house, and other kinds of music would cause the dogs to come and all just lay down in a big clump right underneath her piano. So she called me up, and she asked me if I'd be interested in applying what it is that I know to humans to the canines. And I must say that I politely told her that I would consider it. I got off the phone and I went, oh, my God, every pun came to mind. My career is going to the dog. She's barking up the wrong tree. I could never do that, the whole nine yards. And then I started to think about it, and I started to do a little bit of research. And the more that I dug into it, the more interested I actually became. As a researcher, I'm very familiar with using the databases over at the universities, and I went to Cal Berkeley and then from there to UC Davis, the veterinary college of the UC system. And I came back with, probably 6 inches worth of abstracts, enough to show me what had been done and enough to show me what had not been done. And through the process of it all, I realized that it gave me an opportunity to begin to look at many of the theories and many of the practices that I was using with humans, and to see whether or not they would also apply into the animal world.
So people at that point had done research on the impact of sound and music on animals?
Very limited. Specifically, though, and most recently, in 2002, a Irish behaviorist and psychologist, Deborah Wells from Belfast, had interestingly enough come here to San Francisco and had done a test where she, in the shelters here in San Francisco, where she tested 4 or 5 different kinds of music, classical music, pop music, heavy metal music, rock and roll, in the shelters to see what was the effect of it. These were P-factored test, clinical data test, done appropriately. And what she found was that, without a doubt, dogs actually had a musical preference, that they actually did calm down with classical music, whereas the other kinds of music actually either had a neutral effect or served to actually increase levels of anxiety.
So it was not necessarily the pacing of the music or the volume of the music. It was, in fact, the style of the music?
It was the style of the music. And so when I saw that, I thought, this actually gives me something to build on. I don't have to now go and do the research in terms of whether or not it's classical music versus heavy metal music that has an effect. What I can do is say, since I already have a great love affair with classical music and have for the last 10 years have been producing a specialized classical music for use in clinics and classrooms around the world, so it was home base for me, I went, all right, great. She's already proven that classical music has a specific effect on the dogs. Now, is it possible that through a very specific use of tempo, tone, and pattern, that I can rearrange classical masterworks. And I can then begin to test that and find out whether or not it has a greater impact than generic classical music.
So this isn't just about putting on some Bach or Beethoven and watching your dog calm down.
Well, it is about that, but the story evolves from there. Because, yes, is it better for you to put on classical music if you're looking to calm your dog, soothe your dog? Is it better for you to put on classical music than any other kind of music? Yes. But what we found is that it's actually possible to be able to increase the effectiveness, the efficiency of the classical music twice, to make it twice as effective by using music that has been what I call psychoacoustically adapted. And what that means is that I either select music that meets certain criteria, or I take music and I rearrange it so that certain tonal considerations, certain rhythmic considerations, and certain pattern identification considerations are all utilized. And then what we have found is that in the same way as these things affect human beings, they have almost an identical effect on the dogs.
How much of this is the hearing and how much of it is the nervous system?
That's a great question. And the truth of the matter is that I'm going to wager a guess. I always tell my students whenever I teach a class that I don't know is a good answer. And I'm going to invoke the fifth here and say, I don't know the actual answer about this percentage is auditory, this percentage is nervous system. But ultimately, it all ends up in the nervous system. The ear, just like any of the other portals in the head, whether or not it's the mouth, the nose, the eyes, or even the skin, are all ways that we sample frequencies, whether or not they happen to be sound frequencies or different octaves of frequency, whether or not that's visual, you know, light, whether or not it's olfactory, whether or not it's tactile. The whole body is designed, and specifically the orifices in the head are designed to sample different octaves of frequency to then send information to the brain. Am I safe? Ultimately, on a reptilian level, the brain wants to know, A, am I safe? Then B, it wants to know, do I like it? And then C, it's about how do I put it to work? Is the the way that humans will determine that information and then put it into play.
Different for animals?
Oh, I want to say that I'm really a student, and I'm just in the beginning stages of bioacoustics as opposed to psychoacoustics. Psychoacoustics study the effect of music and sound on the human nervous system. Bioacoustics, how do animals use sound to communicate between themselves? How do they make sound? And also, how does the human sound and noise affect the animals? But my sense is that in terms of the nervous system, when we take in sound, it immediately goes up into the brain. Once it's up into the brain, then it's a nervous system issue. And even though dogs do not wag their tails or pant in rhythm, in the same way as we would tap our toes or shake our heads in rhythm, and then, of course, the rhythm that we hear is also having a major impact on our organ system and our hormonal system, all the systems inside the body. My sense, and due to our research, we have come to see that dogs do actually entrain in the same ways that humans do, even though they do not manifest that in a physical way. May I take just a moment and define also entrainment?
Sure.
Entrainment is the process whereby external periodic rhythms will have an impact on our primary pulse systems of the body. In other words, an external rhythm will cause our brain waves, heart rate, and breath to speed up or slow down. Now, it also is internal, because all of our internal organs all have their own rhythms, and they all change with each other and adapt to each other as well. But for the sake of our conversation, we're talking about what is the impact of external rhythms on our internal pulse systems. What we have found is that the external rhythms that we use in the specialized soundtracks that we are creating have the impact of speeding up or slowing down the nervous system of the dogs. No one has ever done any research around this. And to me, this is a big story, because it's really about what is the effect? What is the effect of what we do as humans? What is the effect of the human soundscape on our animals. And we happen to be looking at dogs right now, but truly we can continue this in looking at other animals as well.
We know that dogs have more acute hearing than humans do. Do we also know, or does this mean that they're that much more sensitive to audio stimulus?
Another good question. I would think so. Humans hear from about 20 hertz on the low end to about 20,000 on the high end. Animals hear much lower than that. They can hear and sense the subsonics. Many animals were seen hours before the tsunamis hit, heading for higher ground. They could feel it. They could sense it.
But it's sound.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they're feeling vibration. Remember, vibration is the bedrock of sound, because all vibration, if I can just bracket your first question and just go to that, all sound is based upon frequency, and frequency is the measurement of vibration. And anything that moves on a periodic level, in other words, anything that has atomic structure, everything that has atomic structure, which is just about everything on this planet, has movement. All movement creates vibration. Vibration is measured in frequency. The dogs and other animals are far more highly tuned to frequency. Whether or not we are hearing it, quote unquote, or not, we are sensing it. So humans sense sound from 20 to 20,000 hertz. Dogs go from much lower to up to 50,000 hertz. And that's the reason why people invented the whistles that we can't even hear, but they can hear it. So their ability to hear a wider spectrum of sound absolutely means that they're going to be far more sensitive to sounds that we're not even aware of in our environment that we are creating, and yet they're feeling and having to deal with.
So it's interesting. We become so accustomed to the sounds in our homes and in our offices that we really don't even notice after a time. Do you think that happens to dogs as well?
Oh, that I'm loving every one of the questions that you're asking me there, because these are perfect questions. And
thank
this
you.
Really goes to the heart of the research that we did in the book. After Lisa approached me about doing the music, I said, I will do this based upon the idea that I put it into clinical testing first. And with Dr. Susan Wagner, it was 2 years in clinical testing. When the results came back, we were so amazed by what we saw that we decided that we would write a book about it. The book, once we started to research further, then took on a whole different approach, because the book wasn't about what is the effect of music on the dogs, but it really became more about what is the effect of the entire human soundscape on our animals. And what we came to understand in the couple of years that we spent researching this book is that there are a number of things that take place within the animal psyche, within the animal nervous system, whether or not it's sensory confusion or it's about the orienting response, the effect of intermittent sounds or lack of patterns, about the effect of an overwhelmed sympathetic overdrive or the action-reaction response. We were able to actually identify a half a dozen different things that take place with dogs that are inside all of the time, and they hear sounds and they can't identify what the sounds are. They can't put two and two together and say, oh, the sound of that car alarm out in the driveway means what? They don't know what it means. All they
hear
is the sound.
So it just adds stress.
It adds stress. In other words, they have a nervous system that is taking in data, and they want to complete it. They want to go two plus two. Two is a stimulus. Another two is my reaction. And when I put them all together, then I know what to do. They don't get the other end of the equation, and so because they don't, then they end up basically like a computer that takes in data and then is looking to store the data in the proper file on the desktop.
So it's scanning, scanning, scanning.
That's
scanning.
It. Exactly. And they don't ever get to complete it. And so by not completing it, what is the net effect of taking in any kind of sensory data? But here we're talking specifically about auditory data. What is the effect of taking in this data but never being able to complete it? We believe there is a reason why 1 in 7 dogs in America, and there are 77 million dogs, that means 11 million dogs in America now have behavioral issues. Is it possible, and this is a hypothesis, and it needs far more research and far more study, but on a common sense basis, when I start to look at this, I just go, if you have a being, whether or not it's two-legged or four-legged, regardless of hair count, All right. If you have a being that has got far more sensory data than it knows how to process over a long-term period of time, it's going to act out in some way. So when we say, oh, that's a behavioral problem because the dog defecates all over your best Persian rug or tears up your couch or is always in a state of anxiety and chews on themselves until they bleed or whatever, is it just that they're doing that because they have nothing better to do and they're bored? Or is it actually because their nervous system is getting so overstressed, that they're so fried, they're getting so proverbially toasted that they have no other way of basically communicating with us, help. So, I need help. I need help. I'm in your environment and I need help.
So some would say, give them drugs. You would say?
I would say play music. I would say play specific kinds of music. I think that the deal with the drugs is a very big issue. And we know that the drug companies see a very big market and they, in many cases, have some solutions. I personally am more of a naturally, holistically inclined kind of guy. And so I look to find ways to deal with the cause as opposed to just the symptom. For us, what we have discovered is that in the same way as music and sound can be used therapeutically with people, now what we know with through a dog's ear is that music and sound can be used therapeutically, like a sound therapy, with our dogs as well. No side effects, and it can't. There's no way that a dog can be hurt by trying to use sound unless they ate the CD.
Joshua, you've said for the last 10 years you've been really interested in classical music. My guess is when you were 17, perhaps even 27, you were interested in a different kind of music, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
rock and roll, loud. I was cranked it up.
Cranked it up as loud as I could get, and rock and roll in one ear and out the other.
There you go. So our tastes in music and sound change as we get older. We don't like loud music as much. We want to turn down the volume, which is fascinating because I don't know about you, but I'm actually experiencing a tiny bit of hearing loss mm-hmm. at this stage of life. Mm. Is that true for dogs as well? Do they have different musical preferences or degrees of sound tolerance as they age?
Joanne, I wish that I could speak with you for hours because you're asking me such wonderful questions, every one of them. Again, there is actually a dearth of research. There needs to be a lot more research in terms of what is the effect not only of sensory integration with our animals, but specifically what's taking place on the auditory system. In terms of the difference between why it is that most of us loved loud, fun, big bass rolled right on up, energetic rock and roll when we were young. Not only was it because it was really fun when we were younger, but it's all hormonally driven. It all has to do with what we self-medicate with sound. We don't really realize that that's what we're doing, but we are attracted to the kind of sound that we want to either arouse and stimulate our nervous system or soothe it. As we grow older, our auditory system, like so many other parts of our bodies, begin to change. Our tolerances to loud sound is a physiological reaction due to the fact that the cilia hair cells are changing due to the exposure that we've had over our lifetime to loud noise in our culture. The fluid within the ear is becoming a little bit more gel-like as opposed to more liquid-like. And so it doesn't give us the same ability to be able to move with the vibrations of sound. And so sudden loud sounds hurt our ears as we get older as opposed to when we're younger, then it stimulates our nervous system. Young people are looking for stimulation. As we get older,
We've had enough.
And our nervous system actually...
Been there, heard that.
Been there and heard that. And our nervous system is actually in a place where it doesn't have the same tolerance. It can't take in as much because of the fact that our tolerances have been diminished in the same way as somebody who doesn't feel well. Have you ever noticed that at times if you have a bad headache, your ability to deal with light or your ability to deal with sound is very different than if you're first thing in the morning and you're feeling just great. And so our sensory tolerances change according to our physical, our emotional, our psychic relationship to the day, let alone our age-related approach.
Back in the 80s, it became popular to play particular types of music for our babies when they were still in utero. I recall the thinking was that it would calm them or even sharpen their minds. Was there science behind that thinking?
Yes, there was, and there's a big debate around all of this. One of my colleagues, Don Campbell, wrote a book called The Mozart Effect, and it was based upon the testing that was done at the University of California at Irvine by Dr. Shaw and Dr. Raschauer. And in their studies, they were looking at particular piano pieces by Mozart, and when they played them, the sense was that students were smarter for a certain period of time, that their brain function, cognitive function was sharpened. It ended up that these tests, they've had difficulty in being able to reproduce the effects of these tests. And I think that this is something that they'll continue to look at for a long time because everybody loves music and everybody is looking to find ways where we can employ it as well as it being an aesthetic pleasure in our lives. My belief is that clinical protocols aside, there is a way that music can either do one of two things. It either arouses the nervous system or it soothes the nervous system and anywhere in between. If we want to have an effect in terms of accelerated learning, we already know from Georgi Lozanov, the man who created accelerated learning, he's considered to be the grandfather of accelerated learning, from Sofia, Bulgaria. This man realized that if you can create the mind-body state of body relaxed, mind alert, it gives us an environment whereby we will be able to take in information and retain information longer. Now, in the Western mind, we're looking to say, okay, how do we do it? What's the one, two, and three of it? And we will figure that out. But we do know if the body's relaxed and if the mind is alert, then we have the state that is most conducive to what it is that we're looking to accomplish. Somebody could say the same thing about healing. Somebody could say the same thing about productivity. Someone could say the same thing about consciousness exploration and meditation. It's all about what is the appropriate mind-body state that is conducive to an activity. We help to establish that, hopefully with beautiful sounds. And then we find that all of a sudden music is not only able to help us in our lives, whether or not it's as humans, whether or not it's about healing something or about taking something that already works fine, but enhancing it. And now what I have come to understand with Through a Dog's Ear, with the music and with the book, is that the application of these same principles apply not only to dogs, but they apply to fish. And believe it or not, they even apply on a certain level to, not meaning to be a punster here, but to the ears of corn. That in other words, there are people that are working currently with certain frequencies to see what is the effect on agriculture. And they are having a phenomenal result. And most interesting, finding out that when they play a 5,000 hertz tone, it causes the stomata cells on the leaves of agriculture to open up to be able to receive the nutrients of dew.
Which makes sense when you consider that it is really just vibration.
That it is just vibration. And the piece that I want to just add to that is that 5,000 hertz tone corresponds to bird song. So in other words, the sounds that the birds make have an effect on the agriculture. And the birds go away, and all of a sudden the agriculture needs all kinds of artificial stimulus in order to be able to help it to do what it's been doing for millions of years already. The interconnectivity, the birds and the agriculture, the sounds and the dogs, the music and the human beings, it's all tied together. It's all, as we know from the work of Al Gore and all the other scientists that are exploring the issue of sustainability and what's taking place on our planet right now with global climate change. It's all tied in. And for me, if I was going to retitle this book about Through a Dog's Ear, I would actually call it Canines in the Coal Mine. Because it's really about how our dogs are reflecting to us what is taking place in our environment. Only we are usually so busy and we have our own strategies for dealing with our overstimulation, that we basically just write it off as being, I have a cold, I have a chronic backache, I have plaque in my arteries, I'm too stressed out. But we don't go and say, is it possible that what is contributing to this stress is that the nervous system is getting completely overwhelmed by too much sensory data? The nervous system goes into chronic overwhelm. The immune system then begins to react by being in a diminished state. We then have got so much toxic environmental stuff going on, the immune system is not able to deal with it. And we wonder, why do so many people have chronic diseases, let alone catastrophic diseases? Why are our dogs getting sick the way that they are? And I'm not saying that sound is the magic bullet.
But it's something to look at.
I'm saying that the whole sensory combine is something to look at. And how do we really find balance in what is a very overstimulated world?
Very, very interesting. Joshua, it's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you so much.
Joshua Leeds, author of Through a Dog's Ear, Using Sound to Improve the Health and Behavior of Your Canine Companion. I'm Joanne Green.